Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Bill King, and he will be speaking on Paradoxes of Paradise, Christians and Technology. Let's listen in on Bill.
Working on a presentation of a different type that goes like this. It's from a German political leader and author that I had never heard of, August Bebel, B-E-B-E-L. Have y'all ever heard of that name? I've never seen him anywhere else in history or political science or literature, but he had this to say. Strictly speaking, the worker who drains sewers to protect humanity from unhealthy miasmas is a very useful member of society. Whereas the theologian who seeks to befog the brain with supernatural transcendent doctrines is an extremely harmful individual. Well, I will try not to befog your brains with supernatural and transcendent doctrines, or at least the kind that are unhealthy. What I'd like for us to do in our time today is really two things. I want to, first of all, have us think a little bit about what's going on in our culture that we have more and more, and yet we seem to be enjoying it less and less. I first worked on this presentation, or a variation on it, a year and a half, maybe even 2 years ago. And it was relevant then, but it strikes me that given what we've seen of late in the political climate, it's even more relevant. That people just really seem to be angry. They're not sure exactly what they're angry about, but there's sort of a general dis-ease that life is not as good as I want it to be, doggone it, and somebody's going to pay for that. Well, I wouldn't go so far as to suggest that technology is at the very root of that, and yet I think there are some connections in there that may shed some light on why we feel kind of at odds with our culture at times, as though we're not quite connecting in the way that we would like to. I ran across a book some years ago, and I put the title over there in case you're interested in following up on it. It's called Trade-Offs, Imperatives of Choice in a High-Tech World by a guy named Edward Wink. He's not a theologian, if I remember correctly. He actually is a public policy analyst. You know, one of those faceless people out of a think tank that renders opinions that you can take or leave depending on where you think they're particularly insightful. But I thought his was particularly insightful when he laid out what he calls some paradoxes of paradise. And that basically what his thesis is this, that we live in a culture that is the most technologically advanced in the world. We have more things. We communicate faster and better and with greater surety than any other culture in the world. We have more disposable income. We have, as he says, created a veritable paradise on earth, or at least that's what some would suggest. And yet, if this is supposed to be paradise, then there are some real ambivalences that most of us live with. And that's what I want to sort of lay out before you. And then, you know, as we're going along, if something strikes you, we have a question, a comment, feel free to jump in and ask that or insert it, because I don't want it to be simply a monologue at you. Life in a technological society is paradoxical. That is, we try to hold two things that seem to be going in opposite directions simultaneously. And it's paradoxical in one sense because we have more knowledge but less understanding. Every year we have 2 million scientific experiments reported in the scientific journals. 2 million experiments, all the data that comes from that. Every day, the Harvard library adds 800 volumes to its stack. So the problem that we've got is not lack of information, lack of data. We have got knowledge coming out of our ears. The problem is, part of the problem is that the learning has become so specialized that it's very difficult for us to even communicate. I know on my campus, Virginia Tech, it's been a long time since the engineers and the folks in the English department could talk to one another in any kind of meaningful way. But what's unusual and what's increasingly disturbing, I think, to the folks at the university is that people within the departments cannot necessarily talk meaningfully to one another. The data has become so specialized that we are really unable to communicate in a meaningful way to one another. You know the classic definition of what a PhD does. He or she learns more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing at all. Anybody who's ever been through a program can understand part of what's going on there. You find your own tiny little niche. Well, I think that comes to, there's some implications for that. One of them is an educational implication that I see a lot in the students with which I minister. A guy named Rustam Roy at Penn State, who's done a lot of work in the area of science, technology, and society, compares the average undergraduate's education to having a model airplane kit and no glue. You get a piece of science and a piece of philosophy and a piece of humanities, maybe, but nobody ever suggests that there's something that holds all the pieces together. There's a lot of pressure in our society, and I mentioned this yesterday in the session when I talked about the engineering professor who said every hour that he spent talking about ethics was an hour that made his students less marketable. There's an awful lot of pressure to become marketable and to focus in on the specific goal. So there's a real difficult time, I think, for us to talk about what are the things that make for wisdom, what holds it all together. It seems to me, and I would love to have somebody debate this point, that what we often turn out in our educational institutions are technicians who know little and care less beyond their very narrow field. And when I say technicians, I don't simply mean the engineers. There's such a thing as an English technician, too. We wrestle with what holds it all together. We know our little piece of the environment, but we don't necessarily know what holds it all together. And the other implication, I think, and perhaps the one that's more generalized for us, is that when you educate people that way, what you produce is a citizenry that's easily intimidated by experts, by people who are not willing to stand up and say, I really don't want that sludge going into my streams, or I really value the quality of life in this place. We tend to be intimidated because we have lots of knowledge and we assume somebody must know how all these pieces fit together. We're sure that we don't, but we assume somebody, usually the expert, does. So that's one of the paradoxes. More knowledge, less understanding. Technology also is supposed to reduce risk, and yet sometimes it creates new risk for us. To take a real simple example, we often hear about the population problem that we have worldwide. Well, part of that problem is not runaway birth rates. Birth rates are about the same. The most radical thing that has happened is we've improved nutrition and we've lowered infant mortality in the third world. So simply, people aren't dying as quickly as they used to. Well, nobody, I think, would argue that we ought to improve or accelerate starvation or cut back on infant immunizations. And yet, we have a situation where the technology has been designed to fight one problem, and indeed we've done a pretty good job of dealing with those problems. in certain situations. And yet we have created another problem that's equally problematic for us. Or another example from the area around which I live in Virginia, near the coal fields. The very machine that is supposed to make the miner's life safer now is moving toward eliminating that job altogether. And so we used to hear an awful lot of stuff about mine safety in the coal fields of Virginia. Now what we hear an awful lot about is the lack of good jobs down there. There's a sense in which, of course, there's nothing new here. Technology always has unintended consequences, both good and bad. If any of you are interested or like to read old Victorian novels, you know, there's always a scene in there where they talk about the fog in London kind of shrouding the streets and all that. Well, you know, that fog has precious little to do with meteorology and an awful lot to do with the implications of the Industrial Revolution gearing up and all the coal that was being belched into the environment. And if you think about it, you know, if you go to London today, you don't generally, for the most part, see that fog. We always have unintended consequences. But, you know, and we continue to, yeah.
One unintended consequence that I can think of that's affected me, I'm an engineer at a paper mill.
Okay.
Okay, with the introduction of computers, it was widely thought that would do away with paperwork.
Uh-huh.
Or greatly reduce it, but there's 10 times more paper generated by computers than there was before computers.
Yeah. And we're not sure what to do.
Everybody wants a report out of this computer.
Yeah.
And there's lots more data coming at us from the computers than we ever had before.
Right. I remember talking with a military planner in our ROTC department, and he's talking about the targeting for artillery strikes. He said, you know, I used to go out and I'd get a one-page reconnaissance briefing. It would say, you know, hit here. Now I get a one-inch satellite printout of this whole area. He said, what am I supposed to do with this thing to do my job? The fact that we have so much data sometimes complicates the way that we try to do the job. And there's always that unintended consequences, and there's nothing necessarily sinister about that. But the more sophisticated the technology becomes, the faster that data comes at us. And the faster those unintended consequences sort of build up one on another. You know, I like the analogy, if you've ever seen the old I Love Lucy, where Lucy and Ethel are on the chocolate conveyor belt, boxing chocolates, you know, and they're going along and they're doing pretty good for a while. They speed the conveyor belt up and there's more and more chocolates, and they're kind of stuffing chocolates in their mouth, trying to keep up with the conveyor belt. Well, I think sometimes that's the way it feels to live in a technological society, that we're stuffing chocolate in, and you know, by the end of the thing, they're throwing the chocolates over their shoulders and throwing boxes away, you know, just anything to get this off of their plate. There's nothing new about this, you know, unintended consequences. What is new is the speed and the scale at which the changes are coming at us, that the consequences are coming at us. One person has suggested that some of the technological crises that we face, such as deforestation or ozone depletion or hunger, for that matter, you know, all of these are kind of like freight trains that are barreling down at us. And it's not going to be simply a matter of being able to hit the brakes and instantly it stops. You know, if you're on a freight train, you know it takes a while after you decide you need to hit the brakes to finally slow the thing down. And so it's more significant, I think, that we have to understand the technological changes that are coming at us, because we need to have the lag time to work on them. Another paradox is that technology is supposed to simplify life, and yet very often we find that it complicates our life. We sometimes don't quite understand the full implications, I think, of what it means to live in a society that's fully dependent on technology. And we only discover that when the beaver or the squirrel bites through the transformer and suddenly the electricity goes out. And you were talking about the computers. Yeah, you want to see a great anguish. You know, wait till the power station at Virginia Tech goes down in the middle of the computing day. It's like the whole world ceases to exist, and people are screaming and yelling, and it's like, we can't do a university anymore.
Parts stores can't find parts.
Parts stores can't find parts. You know. Anybody who's ever had the washer and the lawnmower and the furnace break down on the same day or the same week knows what it means, that technology that was supposed to simplify life suddenly complicates it a great deal. And there's another sense in which our technology can complicate our life, even as it seems to simplify it. Take the car, for example. Now, obviously, that simplifies the task of getting from here to there. But we develop a society that presupposes universal access to a car. Then you develop a mindset that says we ought to be able to get more places quicker, you know, from here to there, and you ought to be able to do that and get from here to there again and again and again. And so we expect ourselves to get more places than we would have if we lived in a simpler culture, or even if we lived in a mass transit culture as opposed to the car. That's not to say we argue against a car. It's to say the technology drives the way we structure our society. We at least need to understand, it seems to me, the implications of the technology and how it affects the way our life becomes a little bit more complicated. Another paradox is we have greater communication but less community. About a year ago, I guess, there was a cover story in the Atlantic magazine, which the title was something like McCulture or Jihad. And the article was posing the thesis, does mass communication, is it going to create for us a universal McCulture, kind of a homogenization where we have greater understanding and greater commonality, or do we have the situation where suddenly folks who were different and apart but didn't know that are suddenly jammed together in a situation that creates a lot of new tension. Now, if you think about it, the title, of course, comes from the tremendous amount of tension in the Middle East with traditional Islamic cultures running smack dab against, you know, Western culture, Western technology, and intrusions. And that's the paradox that we face. We have greater communication. We have never been able to communicate faster or over greater distances and exchange more data, and yet we don't necessarily create this global village. Go ahead.
I think of another example.
Sure.
I like to play cards. I like to play bridge at lunchtime at work. And there's several of us that do that. We get together and play cards. But our computers can talk to each other too. Okay, and there's some that play hearts on a computer between computers. They don't talk to each other, they don't see each other. They're just playing against another person on the computer. That's greater communication but less community.
Yeah, exactly. And we know, and we certainly see that, as you were saying, in the workplace. You know, we have much greater efficiency, quote unquote, you know, with our computers, with our technology. And yet what we're discovering in the ergonomics of it is that people really need to kind of cluster around the water cooler periodically in order to be productive. That it doesn't necessarily improve the quality of life or even the quality of the work in the office to have, you know, high tech operating within that context. Or think about, you know, the most obvious example, and I almost hate to use it because it's been such a whipping boy, but that's television. You know, our television brings us more information quicker, more instantaneously, and whatever you think about the quality of what's on the tube, the fact that it's on a given number of hours a day in the average household has implications for the sense of community that you feel within that household, much less the sense of community along that street. You know, people, you know, who used to hang out on their front porch and talk saying in Watch the Tube. We can say, well, just turn it off and go out. Well, there's a certain momentum that's built into the culture, isn't there? You know, you don't want to be behind the curve on CNN. We want to know the news right up to the minute and feel like we're going to miss something if we're not right on top of it. One of the things I love about coming to Holden is that it gives me an opportunity to do what a guy named Ivan Illich calls techno-fasting. He says, periodically, everybody ought to go on a techno-fast just to remind themselves, you know, what is essential and what is not to the human experience. Again, that's not to say anything against the technology. It's to say that we need to be aware of how it's affecting us. What about this? The paradox in industrial society is that we seek less government, and yet we want more protection. Boy, haven't we seen that? Go ahead.
Going back to that,
sure.
I think that's a transient stage, because I think as you see the telecommuting boom continue, you're also seeing an offshoot of that, where you're having a geographically based community, where you're getting clubs and organizations that are a conglomerate of telecommuters. And so you're moving away from the business-based community to a more geographically local-based community. And yeah. There may be some real advantages to that, because for so long, a lot of the civic clubs had a real difficult time, and to a certain extent continue to, because most of the people were working outside of the community. Okay. Now that a lot more will be working on their houses, they will be working, you know, in their community that they live in. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see some benefits from that over time.
They're just starting to see some new data, you know, some wondering about how this is going to affect the culture. We're going to talk about a little bit about this in the last session on online community. And at this point, it seems to be an open question as to whether people feel greater community once they go online, or whether they form and say, you know, I really have more in common with this other scientist in Moscow than I do with my neighbor, my physical neighbor next door. Because I'm an academic and he's a plumber, this is really my community. And so that's an interesting concept. You know, will our online community undermine physical, spatial community? You know, or what happens, like you're saying, telecommuting, when there's no good reason why I can't live in the mountains of Colorado and do my thing and goose it to the people in New York? You know, what is going to be the implications of that, you know? And it's, you know, there's a whole genre of science fiction out there that tries to explore that. You know, you have these little visions of people in pods whose bodies have atrophied away, and all they do is relate to a computer. Well, you know, I think that's kind of horrific, but it's an interesting question that's posed there. And I think at this point we're not sure what it's going to do to community. I mean, I think that's the data, at least that I've seen, is very kind of paradoxical, to use that word again, very almost conflicting depending on how you read it. One interesting thing that I ran across is, you know, discussing the use of modems and computers at home. They found that if the computer in the home is used by the family for recreational purposes, it has the tendency to promote community. But if dad or mom brings the computer home and uses it for work, then it has a tendency to break up the family and isolate it, because it's just one more way that the work environment intrudes into what used to be sort of sacred space, as it were. You know, and so the kids say, damn it, it's bad enough that you spend 50 hours a week in the office, but now the office is ubiquitous. It's always here. You can always do it. And so it's an interesting implication for, you know, for how we use it. Another interesting thing is that they discovered that you need an extra phone line running into the house, or you have incredible amounts of tension developing. And then as the father of a teenager, I can understand how that would happen. You know, when I'm trying to go online and my son is trying to talk to his girlfriend, we have a meeting of the minds periodically. Another paradox: we seek less government and more protection. And I think that's almost self-evident, you know. But we have gone through a political climate where we're saying, get government off our back, except I want to be sure that there's no hazards that are going to affect me. I really don't want any more love canals. I don't want any more thalidomides. And so we have a real paradoxical attitude toward the place of government in a technological society. We want our protection. We don't want this technology to harm us. And yet we really, really resent the intrusion of somebody telling us what we can do with our property, what we can put into the air as a result of our business, if it doesn't seem to really be hurting anybody. So we have some real ambivalence about that. We have more material benefits and less satisfaction. The glory of the technology that we've had is that for the most part, it has delivered exactly what it promised. Technology has promised we will prolong your life, you will live longer, at a greater standard of living, with less physical effort. That's exactly what we have received. You know, it's one of the great success stories of human history. In that sense, the Industrial Revolution has done pretty much what it promised to do. But that hasn't necessarily meant greater satisfaction in our lives. American college students are the most materially privileged group on the planet, in my humble opinion. And yet, the rates of alcohol abuse climb on campus every year. And my thesis to you is, and you know, and you can take it with a grain of salt, is that alcohol abuse is a form of self-medication for anxiety and depression. It's sort of looking out and saying, this world feels so crummy, I just kind of want to dull myself to the way I'm experiencing. Now, of course, there's always the acting out and the adolescent kind of moving through and rites of passage kind of stuff. But I'm talking about people who stay bombed, you know, 4 days out of seven, who have their weekend that start on a Wednesday and it continues, if they're lucky.
Start in the morning.
Yeah. And go right through. You know, and we can look at other indicators, divorce, crime, mental health statistics, spouse abuse. You know, obviously we're not real satisfied with our technological society's largesse. And my suggestion to you is that it has to do with what I suggested yesterday, and that is we have thought that our basic fundamental problems were amenable to technological solution. And what we in the church have been saying for so long is becoming more and more apparent to the society, even if it doesn't necessarily embrace it in religious language. And that's that there's a deep need that can only be met by religious things rather than technological things. Another paradox, more choices, but we have less time to choose. All of us have a VCR, right? We probably got that, maybe initially, because maybe we just wanted to watch canned movies. But I got mine initially because I like to have the flexibility of taping a show at one time and watching it at another time. But what I quickly discovered was I haven't got time to watch it. You know, so I have this whole stack of tapes over here of shows that were backed up. Lots of choices, infinite choices, but still no more time to choose. Any freshman on a college campus will tell you that ending in a major is not necessarily something that you want. It's the kind of an anxiety-provoking situation. You have all these options spread out here and the need to make a decision now. The basic issue, it seems to me, that we have from our technology is that it creates a lot of options, but we don't have any more time to make the choices.
Or maybe we just have too many options and
yeah.
We can't make the choice.
Well,
so
we're back
to the
massive amount of knowledge.
And therefore, no time.
Yeah. And we feel like we ought to be more efficient. You know, you're talking about the computers in your office. I guess every office was, you know, got the computers because people said, well, you can get more done. Well, how many people who have a computer feel like they have more time than they used to?
You do more.
Exactly. You create more, but the experience is still of being more harried. And if you're not real good with a computer, then you're even further behind, because the expectation is that all this stuff is going to be on the spreadsheet, and maybe you're kind of scrounging around trying to get the formulas in the right way, and you know, so that it actually it takes longer. When I did my master's thesis, my wife typed the thesis because I was such a lousy typist, and there was no way I could get 150 pages of flawless type. You know, and the expectation was I would send them a draft, and they would mark it up. And a month later, I would send them the second draft. Well, you know, the expectation at Virginia Tech is that you send the draft in today, they mark it up, and by the end of the week, you'll have the next draft there. Because the presupposition is, it's obviously on computer, isn't it? And you can make all these changes, including the footnotes, immediately. Well, that's a valid expectation, except maybe the brain isn't working fast enough, you know, in order to make substantive changes. That month felt about right to me to make the substantive changes in the work. I'm not sure a week really accomplishes it. But the expectation, because of the technology, is it will do more and do it quicker. The final paradox I want to hold up for you is more school, but no more critical judgment. And obviously, you know, I've been drawing from my experience as a campus pastor today for this particular presentation. But nobody in the world spends more time in school than Americans getting prepared to go into the world. And yet, we don't necessarily have any greater wisdom in using the technology, the knowledge that's been given to us. You know, we continue to wrestle with what do we do with this tool now. We have a lot more education, but do we necessarily have more wisdom in dealing with it?
Do we also have a lot more education on a lot higher dropout rate too from school? I don't know if that's true, right? It seems like the dropout rate is getting greater.
In high school. Well, I don't think so. I mean, we may have had some surges, but I think we at least get through. People occupy space at a higher rate than they used to. You know, I think, you know, dropout rates people used to sort of disappear off the face of the earth, and nobody really noticed it. You know, certainly I think And if you get outside of urban centers, the dropout rate is not really climbing. But that'd be an interesting thing.
Are people intimidated by all the things that they have to learn now compared to before?
Yeah. Well, what do we as Christians have to say to people who are kind of overcome by all these paradoxes? Let me lay out some things real quickly, and then we'll just kind of go into the three-form conversation. It seems to me that part of what we say is certainly not that we have a blind condemnation of technology. I was talking yesterday about the issue of scientific creationism, and I really think that is kind of a bogus issue from the religious context. You know, I think it's not much of a discussion that's worth having. As I said then, it's bad theology and worse science. But I think there is a danger for the religious quarter, and that is that sometimes we get this sort of what I would call a soppy romanticism about technology, where we say there was this pristine age before technology when all the little animals loved one another and humanity lived in perfect harmony with it. And then came technology and trashed the environment, blah, blah. You know the end of the scenario. Well, I think that's really unfortunate. One, because it's historically not accurate. You know, more large mammals were hunted to extinction before Europeans came to the American continent than after. So this pristine kind of vision is simply not accurate. But more importantly, theologically, it's not very good. You know, in the creation story, we have this narrative where God puts humanity in the garden with a mandate. Take care of this, use it, care for it. And excuse me, that's what technology ultimately is all about. Is how are we going to care for the garden in a way that we can use it without abusing it? And we are are just kind of dealing with a dead end, I think, when we come down in a sort of an anti-technology, Luddite kind of perspective. There's never been a technology-free world. You know, as soon as the first guy, it's probably a guy, maybe a gal, I don't know, picked up a rock, put a nut down, smashed it on there, that was technology. That was using a tool to accomplish a purpose. When you build a fire the first time, that was in altering the environment. And it's going to continue, it ought to continue, and it will continue. So the question then is not, do we have technology, but how do we deal with it? And it seems to be part of what we say is we deal with it within a context of the biblical call to stewardship.
Fire was not invented by us. Fire already
right.
existed.
Okay.
We discovered how to do it.
Discovered how to do it. Right. Right. You know that. I have a wonderful Far Side cartoon that I sometimes use that shows these two cave people sort of hanging around a fire, and over at the next fire is a guy who's gotten a piece of his mammoth meat or something and put it on a stick and stuck it over the fire, as opposed to the two guys at the near fire who are sitting there holding it in their hand over the fire. And the caption is, "Ooh, look what I'll do." Well, you know, technology is something we've had from square one. And, you know, the price of rejecting technology is to perpetually burning our hands in a futile effort to try to do things that we could do an awful lot easier. It seems to me we ought to have a commitment to peace and justice as we talk about technology. As far as I'm concerned, that is the great issue that we as Christians need to be really attuned to. And that is that, as I said yesterday, again, technology is a high-stakes poker game. You got to have big bucks to play. And if you have the big bucks up front, you can potentially get the benefits back. And that is the great challenge, it seems to me. You know, who benefits, for the most part, from the multi-million dollar medical technology? You know, it's not the urban poor. It's not the rural poor in the South. It's folks who have the money to avail themselves of it. You know, who benefits from microcomputers? Again, it's the folks who have the bucks to pay online expenses for the hardware. That seems to me is the great question that we as Christians need to be concerned about, is who is benefiting from the technology and who is paying the price? When we build the road through the city, who benefits from the loop around the city? I would suggest to you it's always middle-class commuters. And who pays for that? Who gets displaced when you build that? It's almost always the poor. The folks without the political clout to stand on. That, to me, is the real technological issue. When the benefits accrue to one group and the costs are borne by somebody else. The issue of research priorities and allocation of resources is one that we as Christians, I think, have got to be constantly asking, who is benefiting from this? I think what we can offer people is a vision of community. You know, in a technological society, all the pressures are pulling us apart. And part of what we can offer is a sense of being in a community together. When I first went to Virginia Tech as a campus pastor, one of the faculty called me into his office and he says, I thought it might be helpful for you to see an organizational flowchart of the university. I said, yeah, that'd be great. So he hands this thing across the desk to me, and it was a picture of three outhouses vertically aligned. And on the top, it had administration, and directly below it was faculty, and directly below that was students. Well, you know, and that was his vision of the flowchart of Virginia Tech. A rather graphic way to talk about the breakdown of community. And I suspect, you know, any one of us could think of subcultures, whether it's our job, certain elements of clubs we've dealt with or something, where the flowchart would look pretty similar to that, or at least on some days it would feel that way to us. Part of what we can offer as the church, as the people of God, is an alternative to that sense of of literally being dumped on by one another. That here is an opportunity for us to join together in a community, you know, where we care for one another, where the burdens are borne within the community, where I am concerned about your welfare in addition to my own. Another thing that I think is going to increasingly become important is that we Christians can offer a positive understanding of sacrifice. That's a concept that's very, very alien to most of our culture. You know, we really don't like the idea of suffering and sacrifice. And yet, for Christians, that's an integral part of our theology. We talk about the value of sacrifice in behalf of the other. My suggestion is that we're going to increasingly be in a society where resources are limited, where we're going to see changes within our culture that are not going to be very pleasant, as resources are have a variety of demands put on them. You know, we often see this these days. I know the students that I deal with are talking about it. You know, where's my piece of the pie? Well, what can we as Christians offer to our society? Can we possibly say that there is virtue in shared sacrifice? That maybe we don't need all the gizmos and gadgets. That maybe there's something to be learned in simplifying and getting by with less. And finally, I think we talk about alternative values to absolute efficiency. I use the term absolute efficiency. That comes from a book by Jacques Ellul called The Technological Society, in which he says that ultimately absolute efficiency is the value which drives society. You know, that we always want efficiency, and that in any kind of discussion about a course of action, the person who can muster the argument that this is more efficient will in the long run win the argument. Well, that means that efficiency can run over human values like justice, like compassion, like beauty. And part of what we as Christians have to offer is a vision that there are values out there that are important to a valuable and to a significant human style that do not correlate well with efficiency. Maybe doing it the most efficient way is not going to be the most humane way to do something. Let me end what I want to say with a sort of one more illustration. I like old movies, and there's one that I particularly like called Inherit the Wind. Does anybody know that movie? Spencer Tracy and some others. It's the film dramatization of the play by the same name that has to do with the Scopes monkey trial. And in that movie, Spencer Tracy plays Clarence Darrow, and he's making his sort of closing argument to the jury in defense of the school teacher who taught evolution. And he says this: progress has never been a bargain. You have to pay for it. Sometimes I think there's a guy who sits behind a counter and says, "All right, you can have a telephone, but you lose privacy and the charm of distance. Madam, you may vote, but you lose the power to retreat behind the powder puff and the petticoat." Boy, I'd like to see what people would say about that these days. "You may conquer the air, but the birds will lose their wonder and the clouds will smell of gasoline." Well, I think that in a nutshell sort of, you know, sums up what I've been trying to hold up to you, is that there's always a paradoxical nature to a society that relies on its technology. You know, there are always trade-offs. And the question is not, will there be trade-offs or will there be costs? It's, are we willing to make them? And have we articulated what those costs are? Do we know what we're paying for when we buy in to the technological wonders that in some ways are very much making a paradise on earth? Okay, that's what I want to say to you. Any comments or questions? Let's see if we can have some conversation back and forth here.
I've got a question Sure. Going back to what you're saying about college students, are they verbalized what they think the source of their anxiety is to you, or is it something
that Well, we've got some college students here. Does that resonate with you all?
Wait, no? Question.
Whether there's dis-ease among students. Is that... I can tell you what my perception is, but I would like to hear what some other people who are on the trenches would say. Yeah.
I saw a little thing on TV the other day, and it was talking about Generation Xers, and part of the frustration is feeling like what you said yesterday, that the horizon doesn't look as promising for them as if their parents, you know, they don't feel like they have the same kind of hope, and they don't really fit in anymore.
They know the boomers are always going to be on top of the corporate ladder as they work their way into the... That make me depressed if I'm looking at that. Yeah. I mean, that's part of what I hear. Is just sort of sense of the horizon has been closed. The American dream isn't really for me anymore. Give you the best example I can think of. You know, we have a significant number of engineering students, you know, who graduate from Tech each year and at least are temporarily unemployed. Now, when I went through college, I mean, back in the early 70s, as long as you got through, you could be pretty sure having a job when you got out, even if you partied and smoked dope and everything else, as long as you got out. These are high achievers, and they look at it and they just hope to God that the industrial cycle is such that when they come out, engineers are getting hired. Now, and I use engineers because that's far and away the most marketable group that comes out of our university. You know, folks.
I graduated in 1973. There were many other trades or professions that weren't being hired, but engineers were.
Yeah. And
so when you say they were one of the most marketable professions, that's certainly true.
Yeah. I mean, and there's some that are very cyclical, like aerospace engineers or something that, you know, even in boom times may or may not. But for the most part, I think that's part of it is economic. I think part of it has to do with what I would call the abrasive secularity of the culture. It's just sort of a breakdown in the sense of belonging to a community. Where do I fit into this society anymore? I don't really feel like I belong at home. I think we're seeing, you know, the lag time of, you know, families under tremendous amount of pressure, parents working two jobs, not being able to invest time with their kids. And so we see the divorces, we see the alienation, they come to college and really don't have appropriate models for how to be in relationships. And not having those, that tends to snowball into some pretty crummy situations on campus. And when you get into crummy situations, you feel pretty crummy about yourself, so maybe promiscuous sex, maybe booze, maybe drugs. And of course, you get this sort of snowballing effect, which may, you know, kind of culminate in you screwed up so bad you are out of school and you're back home with your parents, which is worst of all.
Absolute efficiency. Your last statement there, alternatives to absolute efficiency. One of the things I think of is hope. I think that hope is an alternative to absolute efficiency. Where absolute efficiency exists, there's no room for hope. Hope is taking time out to dream about what things might be like, or creativity, or if you're not satisfied with the way things are and you can't get out of it, at least there's hope. Someday, you think about what heaven might be like. You might think about what it might be like if you won the lottery ticket. And these are dreams, and they help you get through life, I think, as hope. Mm-hmm. And there's no room for that in absolute efficiency.
Right.
No room for daydreaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The pace of life puts so much pressure on to know what you want now. You know, what always interests me, or not interests me, I find it kind of scary, is that when I came through college, you could not declare a major until your junior year. They wouldn't allow you to. Now, you better know that you want to be an engineer when you're a junior in high school, or you probably won't have the prerequisites for the program. Well, you know, who knows what they want to do with their life at that point? I mean, you know, you're still worried about acne. And yet, see, that's, I think, symptomatic of the pressure. The average number of major changes at Virginia Tech is 4. And you think about that. There are some people, again, particularly engineers, who come in very goal-directed, have one major. So somebody out there has got 8 switches.
But even then, you know, they have so many choices. Back to the choices
thing. Yeah.
It's not a matter of being an engineering major. It's a,
right.
You know, are you a civil engineer? Are you a computer engineer? Are you a, you know, there
industrial?
Engineers. Right, you know, the different options are just, you know, tremendous.
And it's getting worse, and it's not changing. I mean, these ideas that we had in the board, is an individual going to change it, or is a political party going to change it, or a group going to change it? And we're just running downhill down the other direction so fast. And you wonder where we'll be in 20 years, 40 years, mm-hmm. and can the human take it?
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that's kind of scary about the pace at which we're going is that we're not even sure how to project the implications anymore. You know, we're not sure what online community is going to mean for the workplace. You know, when you read the literature, it's all over the board as to what is going to happen. And you sort of project based on this technology, and suddenly this thing is totally obsolete. I remember when I was in college, being a key punch operator was touted as the job of the future. By the time I got through graduate school, the last key punch machine was being phased out. You know, we're not even sure at this point what the issues are going to be. And that's why I think it's real important for us to get through our minds that the fundamental issue is not the technology. It's not the science per se. It has to do with the quality of the community that we desire to create. You know, the values, the things that are needful for the human experiment, are not going to change that radically. So part of what we need to be about, it seems to me, as the church, is sort of that mustard seed that says, the rest of the ground may be barren out here, but in this little piece, we are going to create a community. Now, and we're not, and don't hear me saying we're going to have a fortress here, where we create this little community and we all huddle around it and look over our shoulders and guard it. You know, I'm real concerned about the fortress mentality that we're seeing in our political climate this day. I'm saying we create this community and say this is where we will stand and invite others to share the vision. It seems to me that's what Jesus was about.
Well, it seems to me too that the church could take a more proactive stand too, because I mean, like, who's making the decisions about what more technology do we need? You know, is the church, are they the ones that said, you know, what we really need is some genetic engineering? Let's splice this gene and this gene to make a perfect Christian. They're not doing that. They're saying, let's take this gene out and throw it out so we can cure multiple sclerosis. So that's what they're doing. And so who's making those decisions? I don't think, you know, the church is. Or, you know, do we need a smaller cellular phone? Or do we, you know, what do we need? What more technology do we need? Do we need to have another plan? You know, those kinds of decisions the church, I think, can be involved in, rather than letting someone else tell us what's going to be good for us technologically in the next century.
Mm-hmm. And certainly as individuals, we can choose what technologies we will avail ourselves of. You know, yeah, and just really ask the question, do I really need these things? You know, there's an awful lot that, you know, it's often talked about the technological imperative, that if we can do it, we always do it. And I think that's one of the questions that we as Christians lift up. Are there things that we are perfectly capable of doing that for other reasons we will not do, we choose not to do? And genetic engineering is one of the ones that's really pushing us to ask that question. You know, are there things that we are technically capable of doing that really should not do, will not do? Or at least we ought to raise those questions up and make explicit the values that are undergirding the decision.
We want to know who's making that decision.
They
are making the decision.
It's get identified.
Yeah.
It's the profit one, it's the Bill Gates, it's the politicians, it's the world competition. That's what's making the decision.
And you wonder how many peddlers there are.
Well, I think we are past our time, and I'm supposed to be on dish team, so I know my wife is eager for me to be there. Thank you all for being here. Our next session will be on designer genes, some of the implications of genetic engineering and fertility techniques.
Thank you.